Okay, so this is Juhi Kwan. Today is July 27th, 2013. I'm currently conducting a phone interview with Professor Nguyen for the Asian American Reproductive Justice Oral History Project. So thank you so much for taking time out and doing this. And I was wondering if you could start from the very, very beginning, if you could give us a quick intro and maybe some family background, how you grew up, and also how you developed your political consciousness.
Okay. Gosh. Let's see. I actually came to the U.S. Well, I was born in Vietnam, and at the age of 7, my family and I escaped from Vietnam as part of the Bo People exodus, and we came to America in 1979, and we first lived in Virginia for a year, and then my family and I moved over to California. And I think having gone through that experience as a child, I didn't quite understand at the time why we were leaving Vietnam. But I think when we came to Virginia, I very quickly learned about how I was very different from everyone else, because I think I was only one of two or three Asian students in the entire school, and all the other students were mainly Caucasian. White, and so I knew from a very young age what it meant to be different. And I didn't know any English at the time, and so I was put into an ESL class. And so I knew at a very young age of what it meant to basically feel left out and not part of the normal crowd. And so I think growing up with that kind of background, it made me very aware. And it made me very empathetic towards others who were not as easily accepted into the regular, normal activities in school and as part of social life in general. And I think having that experience really made me, I think, lucky in the sense that the work that I'm doing today is an outgrowth of that. And I think I get a lot of meaning from being able to work in the community and to be able to develop a lot of the services that I wish I had growing up as a kid. And so I think, you know, in a nutshell, that's how I developed my political consciousness from a very young age.
Yeah. So from ESL all the way to professorship at Cal State Fullerton, what kind of educational path did you take in terms of high school, college, and then your life after college as well?
Yeah, so I'll fill in the blanks. That was a big jump, right, from 7 years old to college. I went to school in Virginia for a year, and then we moved to California, and I went to elementary school in Orange County, and that was a big change, because coming from Virginia to Orange County, it was sort of the opposite experience, being surrounded by a lot of Asian communities.
And was it specifically Vietnamese folk? Was there a Vietnamese community already?
So when we first moved here, we lived in Tustin, and we moved around to the outskirts of Huntington Beach and Westminster, and mainly there were a lot of Vietnamese students at that time, and then a few years later on, I went to Monterey Park, and that's where I went to middle school and junior high. And as you know, Monterey Park is the Chinese Beverly Hills, what they term the Beverly Hills in Chinatown up in Monterey Park. And so I was surrounded by a lot of Chinese and other Asian ethnic groups as well. And then after Monterey Park, we moved to Irvine, and I went to high school in Irvine. And so again, a lot of Asian communities, and mainly Taiwanese, Chinese. And I went to UCI for my undergraduate education, and was a bio major, and quickly learned that I actually gravitated more towards the humanities, because I took a humanities course and really fell in love with just writing and reading the classics and also being exposed to Asian American studies for the first time mm-hmm. at UCI. And I got involved in a lot of activism in joining certain clubs and mm-hmm. Organizations like the APA Student Association. There was a refugee organization at that time called Project Help or Project Pearl. And mm-hmm. they basically helped Vietnamese refugees coming from Vietnam. And so I was able to volunteer during my freshman and the summer of my freshman year. I went on a volunteer trip to Southeast Asia and volunteered in the refugee camps in places like Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Indonesia. We went basically throughout Southeast Asia, wherever the refugee camps were, and that just totally changed my perspective on things because I realized how privileged I was in the sense that I was getting an education that mm-hmm. a lot of other minors were not being able to access. And mm-hmm. my role in volunteering on the trip was to interview unaccompanied minors, meaning that these were kids under the age of 18 who had left Vietnam as Bo people, and they left without their parents or any adults, basically. They went mm-hmm. alone, and so there was no one looking out for them, no one to protect them. And mm-hmm. when they came to the refugee camps, at that time you had to go through a screening process in order mm-hmm. to get accepted into the U.S. And since they didn't have any family with them, they didn't quite know what to do. They couldn't prove basically any of their status as refugees. And so my job was to interview them and get their stories. And then after that summer, I went back to Washington, D.C., and spent about two months in Washington, D.C., and worked with refugee organizations to try to get them to hear these cases of unaccompanied minors so that they could get accepted into the U.S. And so that helped me to understand the political system as well as how certain things worked in D.C., and so that was really an invaluable experience to look at the policy issues and how you can affect and create change through policy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then after, go ahead.
Oh, how did you get into community health and that aspect of your work?
Yeah. So I majored in biology, and because I love the humanities so much, I decided to double major in comparative literature. And mm-hmm. after graduating from UCI, I have thought about going to medical school. My parents are both in the health field. My dad is a dentist. My mom is a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. they always encouraged me to go into the health field because they knew it was a stable profession. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to become either a dentist or a pharmacist, but those two careers never really appealed to me. So I did many internships during college and didn't see them as something that I could see myself doing, and medical school was something that was interesting to me, and so I went through all the classes, took the MCAT, and applied to schools, but I didn't get accepted into any medical schools, and so I took a year off and worked as a physical therapist aide, and sort of try to figure out what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine was going to public health school at UCLA at that time, and she said, you know, this is so interesting. Medical school, public health is something that a lot of schools are thriving upon, and this is a good way to experience. And at that point, I didn't really know what public health was or, what the field was really, so I did some research and found it and decided to apply to UCLA and got in. To their master's in public health program. Mm-hmm. And when I went into that program, I thought, well, you know, this is a good stepping stone, right, to medical school. Mm-hmm. And as I got into the program and learned more about public health, I really became interested in it as a career and as a profession. And after I mm-hmm. finished my master's program, after 2 years, I was offered a fellowship by my advisor at that time. And she said, I think you have a lot of potential, and I think you should go on and get your PhD. And she offered me a fellowship, and I thought, wow, you know, when is this opportunity ever going to come again? And someone's paying me to continue with school. And so I took her up on the offer and applied for the PhD program and got in. And then that basically just opened up all kinds of doors because I got involved in working in cancer and also working specifically with a lot of Asian Pacific Islander communities. My advisor was Marjorie Kagawa-Singer. I don't know if you know.
Oh, yeah, I do know her, yeah.
Yeah. So she was my main advisor, and she got me involved in a bunch of research projects, and I met a lot of people in the community and really found a lot of joy and meaning in working with these folks on all kinds of different health programs, mainly around breast and cervical cancer in the Asian Pacific Islander community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How does your work relate to Professor Thora Park Tangesiri's work? You guys have a very parallel life. I already interviewed her, and I
did. Okay.
Yeah, she also did public health, did cancer. So how does your work relate with each other?
Yeah, so because Margie was my advisor, she got me involved in a lot of the research that she was involved with. And so I got involved in the cancer field because of Margie, basically. And she got me involved in a project. We were working with APCHO at that time. Are you familiar with APCHO? Yeah. And they had a breast cancer project where we worked with several organizations nationally. And it was my first exposure to working with the Pacific Islander communities, too. And so a lot of the work that I'm involved in today is because of Margie and how she introduced me to a lot of her research that she was working on at that time. Yeah.
So do you do a lot of research now? But I also know that you do the NAPAS, California Young Women's Collaborative. How does that relate to the rest of your work?
Yeah, so I've found that in the past few years, I've had a lot more interest in working with youth programs and younger folks, high school as well as college. And when I first started teaching the NAPAS class, Lisa Fu, she was working at NAPAS at the time. Do you know Lisa?
Yeah, she used to be an organizing director, is that right?
Yeah, so she used to work with NAPAS, and she was transitioning out of her role then. And she connected me with NAPAS to propose having us teach the CYWC class. And this was the first time that the class actually became a class. So in the past, NAPAS had CYWC as sort of a special project. And line up through independent study, or it was a special project that NAPAS came into colleges and tried to recruit students as a special study that they could do on their own. But at Fullerton, we decided to turn it into a formal class. And
so before, when it wasn't a class, who actually advised the students?
It was Amy Lum, and she was a staff at NAPAS. And
okay.
So, so basically she came in to recruit students at the colleges, and then it was basically just a project of NAPAS, and they used the campuses as their site to recruit students.
Yeah.
But it used to be very small. It was maybe 5 to 12 students in any 1 year that they did that. And when we brought it to Fullerton and opened it up as a formal class, we got a lot of interest, and also not just from girls, but also from male students, because we can't restrict, right, the class.
Yeah.
We have to open it up. And so that really changed the direction of things and opened up a whole new way of training young college students about reproductive health and involving that male voice, I think, was really valuable because it brought in a new perspective. And mm-hmm. even though it was still supposed to be a space for training young girls to become leaders, mm-hmm. I think having the guys and the male students in the class, it trained them to be allies. And mm. so that was a really good experience, I think, for all the students.
Yeah. How do the, like when the students come in or when they're reading the syllabus or whatever, and then they're signing up for this class, what are some of their ideas of what the class is going to be? Because when I sign up for classes, and if I had seen a reproductive justice class before I knew about the RJ movement, I don't exactly know what I would expect out of it.
Right. Yeah. So I had to explain a lot in the recruitment, since it was the first time that the class was offered. Students had a lot of questions, like what is this class about? And the way that I framed it, I made it more of a general introduction to community health issues uh-huh. with a special focus on reproductive health and sexuality as well. I put in mm-hmm. their sexual health, and so that got a lot of students interested. But the way that I structured the class, it was more on learning about Asian Pacific Islander community health issues, but with a special focus mm-hmm. on women's issues and sexual and reproductive health. And so it made it a little mm-hmm. bit broader and more accessible to a lot of students because, you know, sometimes when students don't have exposure to these kinds of classes, they get scared off, or if they're not yeah. familiar with it, they're not likely to sign up for it. And also because mm-hmm. the class, it was a new class and it didn't satisfy any general education credit, a lot of students... you know, it took something special, basically, for them to sign up. And so having NALPOF as a sponsor, that was a big incentive for a lot of students to be able to get access to field trips, for example, or possibly, being involved in something bigger than the class itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What kind of field trips did you go on?
So for the first class, we had the students go to Sacramento as part of the mm-hmm. API Policy Summit. Usually every year there's an organization called APIs CAN that mm-hmm. it stands for APIs California Action Network, and they organize a policy summit in Sacramento. And so that was the perfect opportunity for the students to learn about policy issues and what kind of voice they could have on the national level. And so we took them to Sacramento, and it was a good capstone to the class because it's a year-long class. And so mm-hmm. the first semester, we teach the students about community-based participatory research methods and what it means to have these kinds of spaces for API communities to be able to talk about their health issues and to become active in their own community health. Mm-hmm. And then the second semester, we actually have the students do social action projects where they take the data that they collect and they analyze it, and then they go out into the community to try to basically educate others about the issues and to come up with projects where they are able to talk to their peers on campus as well uh-huh. as other community members about why it's important to, learn about sexual and reproductive health issues in the community.
Mm-hmm. When was that first class? What year was it?
This was in 2009, 2010, so we started in fall of 2009. And then it ran through the spring of 2010.
Oh, and has it been going on every year?
No, so the first time that we taught it, it was that year, that was the first time that it was offered as a class. And then mm-hmm. the following year, NALPOF wanted to open the opportunity to other colleges because mm-hmm. This program has been to UC Berkeley, UC Davis, San Francisco State, they've been trying to get it into different colleges. Mm-hmm. And so after Fullerton, it was at UCI, And then the year after, they were supposed to do it at UCLA, but mm-hmm. then they decided to stay at UCI to see how it would work out as possibly a permanent class.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, they decided to bring it back to Fullerton. And so I think they were trying to get it to UCLA, but that didn't work out. And so they wanted to keep it in Southern California.
Yeah. I actually went to the March Summit where your class presented with the information and everything like that.
At UCI?
Oh, not at UCI. In Washington, D.C.
Oh, right, this year. Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was really impressive.
You were there? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I went to the little presentation.
Wonderful.
Had never seen so many students interested in it.
Yeah.
So there could be a class.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so a lot of the students who were there presenting, that was our whole class, basically. I think we were only missing one student who couldn't go. But, it was really awesome to be able to do it with University of Minnesota this year as well. So mm-hmm. they were the new cohort, and it was really exciting that it expanded outside of California this year. So I don't know if you had a chance to interview Melissa Kwan yet.
She's a little busy, but I'm trying to get in touch with her. Yeah.
So she's actually from Minnesota, and she basically helped to write the grant to be able to get funding for teaching the class over in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. I know that you said that you present the class in a kind of a broader community health perspective, but what kind of background do you have in reproductive justice and like having that gender lens to look at health issues?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work that I've been doing in my PhD studies and also in the community has mainly been with women. So mm-hmm. with breast and cervical cancer, we worked with mm-hmm. a lot of different women from all kinds of API communities. And I think having that experience really helped me to have that gender perspective in terms of how important it is to have a space for women to be able to talk about their issues, but also looking at it from the perspective of how important it is to involve the family and to involve mm-hmm. The male allies and the male perspective as well in these types of issues. Because I think traditionally in public health, oftentimes programs tend to focus on the people who are going through the health issues. So with mm-hmm. breast and cervical cancer, right, a lot of work is centered around getting the woman in for screening and educating them about the issues and reducing the stigma around mm-hmm. the screening. But we found in working with the API communities that it's just as important to involve the men and the family members, because oftentimes mm-hmm. they're the ones who are driving the woman to their appointments, right? Or
right.
they're the ones who sometimes are finding the cancers
mm-hmm.
while they're having sex, or, you know, they're having it's the males and the family members who are affected when they get diagnosed with cancer, for example. And so mm-hmm. we found that it was just as important to educate these members, just as important as it was to educate the women themselves,
mm-hmm.
because you need that support system. And so I think having that perspective and coming into the reproductive health and sexual health and reproductive justice field, I saw how important it was to also involve, right, the male allies and while at the same time pointing out the gendered political consciousness and
mm-hmm.
The need for that space for the girls to develop their leadership skills. And so I think it's a happy medium in terms
mm-hmm.
of involving the male allies and their family members, and I think it's a tough balance sometimes to be able mm-hmm. to provide that space for the girls, but also have that space for the male students to be allies, right? And mm-hmm. then when you involve family members, it also opens up a whole can of worms in terms of what are your responsibilities, right, to educate the moms, the dads, because we ran across a lot of issues about how the students in the class would be learning about these things, and then they would talk with their moms or dads or family members, mm-hmm. and the responsibility of having to educate, right, those family members and letting them know what's going on, and then it opens up all kinds of conversations about, you know, why you need to get screened for certain things, and why are you having sex, and, you know, things like that. And so I think it's really interesting how it's spread. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there some kind of, like, silence or stigma around talking about specifically, like, breast cancer, cervical cancer, or sexual health?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. So I think a lot of the work that's been done in the last decade or so, mm-hmm. A lot of it has concentrated around educating women and their families about the stigmas that are attached and how cancer can strike anyone, right? It doesn't discriminate. Mm-hmm. And in terms of sexuality, I mean, you probably are very aware in the API communities, a lot of these issues are never talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that we work through in class, and at first the students are very shy to talk about these issues, right? And they don't want to touch it, and they get very giddy and, you know, giggles. And by the end of the school year, you know, they can't wait to talk about it because they learn so much and they realize how important it is.